years ago at another cultural institution that I won't go on about. But Will is a great raconteur, a great storyteller. He has a passion and a good understanding for the process of history, and that was recognised in the institution I worked at, where he was well respected by the staff down there and understood the institution's purpose. Not all of the history he's done is about war, like Beneath Hill 60. He started as a documentary producer in the early to mid-1970s, after graduating from ANU. And I think through the combination of telling history via documentaries and film, and since moving into books, he has an extraordinary opportunity to make, a pretty rare talent to make history accessible and entertaining without losing the essence of the storyline. So I think it's a pretty rare talent, and I knew a lot of historians where I worked previously and who didn't have that talent, who tended to overwhelm people with far too much detail. And I really think that Will has an extraordinary talent in that realm. A couple of things in his career that I wanted to highlight was one about a book that Will edited, really, but had the foresight to bring to our attention, called Somme Mud. And another former colleague of mine, a senior military historian, Peter Stanley, acknowledged that that Will recognised the typescript for what it surely is. In a foreword by Bill Gammage, who's a historian that many of you may know, who wrote The Broken Years, an emeritus professor at ANU, the first AAF's foremost living historian, he compares it to All Quiet on the Western Front as an Australian tale, first-hand tale of the Great War. And Peter sums up Will's editing of Somme Mud in, even if you know the Great War or the AIF, read this book, it will inform, astound and move you, as has little else since Leonard Mann's Fleshman Armour, or indeed Bill Gammage's The Broken Years, which I think is high praise indeed from Peter Stanley, because Peter did a lot of reviews which really tore books apart and left many authors crying in their tea. So I'll hand over to Will now to tell you his story about history and mention the book of the film Beneath Hill 60. Thanks, Will.
Thanks, mate. You'll have to excuse me, I've got a bit of a cold, so I might have to have a little drink every now and again. Can you hear me? Is this microphone okay? Yep. All of us here today probably have one thing in common. We love history, and in one way or another are engaged in making this accessible to others. Perhaps we teach history, write about it, research it, maybe we catalogue and store history, make it available through a library system such as this. Or perhaps we study it, hoping to learn more, and from this, better understand the past. In my case, I do most of the above, but I'm engaged in one historic process that is probably quite unique. I make films about history. And it is in the process of this work that I have to confront history, ask questions of it, and see just how I can make it both informative and entertaining. That's often a difficult task, because you're drawing that line between fact and reality, you're drawing that line between getting it right, yet at the same time needing to make it accessible, palatable, and certainly entertaining. Perhaps I should start by explaining how I found myself as a history producer and more recently the author of historic books. My interest in facts started as a child. I remember in third class seeing a black and white film about Australian explorers and was completely smitten by history. I found pantomime stupid and instead had colouring in books about historic subjects, American history as it turned out, like the Boston Tea Party, Paul Revere and Geronimo. This had a relevance to me and was far more interesting and real than actors, kids' books and later science fiction. At university, I did a double history major as part of my BA at ANU and started my film career as a lowly production assistant in a graduate program at the Commonwealth Film Unit, now known as Film Australia. This was in 1972. In mid-1975, I went to the USA, worked and lived in Hollywood, not as a film person, as it turned out, but as a short order cook on Sunset Strip. before being deported in 1976 for working illegally. I went to the BBC in Bristol, the home of the famous Natural History Unit, as at that time my interest was on wildlife filmmaking, the environment, and something I spent the majority of my time at Film Australia working on. And here was the leading producer of wildlife in the world, where at that time they were making the very first series of David Attenborough's Life on Earth. Here I did not in fact do wildlife, but rather worked on a history series about British wealthy families, the landed royalty, and the estates that had been passed down over many generations. It was in fact my first work in the area of historical films, and their lightweight entertainment, certainly an interesting and engaging project. In 1976, I returned to Australia, and the following year, set up my production company, Look Films. Initially, I worked on small corporate films, known at the time as industrial documentaries, and shot on 16mm. This was before the advent of VHS and videotape. This training on a small scale prepared me well for bigger projects, which were not to come for a few years. Instead, I worked as a freelance production assistant, location manager on a few feature films, and as an assistant producer back at Film Australia, relieving producers when they went on annual leave. The ABC at this time ran documentaries, but very few produced in Australia. They had what they called an output deal with the BBC, which was basically a financial promise to purchase so many hours per year from the BBC catalogue at a far lower cost than we could produce documentaries for locally. This was not only the case with the ABC. The commercial channels did the same, reluctantly needing to buy a basket of documentaries as part of a deal in securing the latest American popular programming. We could not compete against foreign program dumping that was virtually free to the channel and with huge production budgets and hence huge and hence production values. And added to this was an audience interest in this type of programming and conversely a disinterest in anything Australian. We could not win. The watershed for the Australian film industry came in 1982 with the changes to the Tax Act known as 10BA. This allowed generous tax advantages for investors in Australian film. And overnight, there was a massive surge in film production, both in documentaries and feature films. The problem, however, remained the existence of a market. It is one thing now to have the money to make historical and documentary programming, but we needed a broadcast outlet to satisfy the conditions of the new Tax Act. Unless we had a commitment, we could not get our investors to the necessary tax deductions, which meant they would not invest in our project until this condition was satisfied. However, the upside was that broadcasters like the ABC, the BBC, and the Public Broadcast Service in America wanted serious, well-researched historic programming, and there seemed at that time an audience, or a growing audience interest, in this new genre of television production. For me, this legislation and the available money gave me a first break into documentary production. My first project in early 1983 was called The Voyage of Bounty's Child, a historical expedition film about a descendant of Captain Bligh of Mutiny on the Bounty fame, reenacting his great-great-great-grandfather's voyage in a replica boat from Tonga to Kupang in Indonesian Timor. This film was shown on the ABC, one of the first Australian documentaries to be shown. On the BBC and the American PBS network through the leading station WGBH in Boston. As it turned out, the film was popular with audiences, not because it recounted history, even retold the Mutiny on the Bounty story, but was a successful program device, the linking of true adventure, in this case the open boat voyage, with a historical parallel of Bligh's open boat voyage in 1789. In fact, in our story, the story is told by Bligh through the wonderful narrative voice of the late Leo McKern. Here, Bly was able to compare himself to his descendant. And as filmmakers, we could quietly wind in the history with the grim and dangerous voyage of our modern-day expeditioners. Here we were using the device of expedition filmmaking to get history across. My next film threw up a different series of problems and challenges. This too involved history, but this time archaeology. In 1984, I produced the film Death and Destiny, A Journey into Ancient Egypt, directed by Paul Cox and presented by Philip Adams. Philip, who we know, the journalist, advertising guru, collector of everything from antiquity, and in fact, he was the father of the Australian film industry. This time, as a young producer, working with a well-known award-winning director, I needed to give him creative space and make his film, rather than my historical interpretation of what we were seeing. This was a trade-off to get the television sale and hence the tax investors' dollars. And like the Bounty film, there were inherent problems in the production process. It is one thing to be able to research and script a film, but another to turn up with a camera and witness and record a process. In the first film, we were following a voyage and using this as the narrative thread for the historical story. There was no point in a script, as we had no idea what would play out. All we could do was to film the voyage and hope that the small, unaccompanied boat did not get wrecked on the first day. Similarly, in the second film, we were hoping to make a film from material we'd shot in Egypt, but this did not always turn out quite as expected. Here we had especially unique problems. First, we were given no information about what was happening on a day-to-day basis at the dig, and what might be expected to be found as the work progressed. This meant we were not around when anything was discovered, and if we were, did not have enough visual information to properly tell the story. We were actively thwarted in trying, in fact, to tell the story. As a case in point, one late afternoon, the archaeological team broke into an undamaged mastaba, an ancient Egyptian burial tomb with sloping mud sides and a flat roof, in which was a sarcophagus. This was an exciting moment, as undamaged burial pits and tombs were rare, having been looted in antiquity. Here was one with the seal in place, the carved figures undamaged, and the possibility of treasure and historical artifacts very real. Given access, the cameraman squeezed into a small tomb and looked about. In the middle was a raised sarcophagus, the heavy stone lid still in place. Everyone was excited about what might be inside. The archaeologist entered the tomb and on cue slid the heavy stone lid to the side. What was inside? The audience was screaming to know. But can you believe? It was suddenly 3 p.m. and the workers had to be released to walk back to their local villages. No more filming today. We can pick this up in the morning, we were told. When we came back in the morning, however, we found that the tomb had been closed and sealed and the dirt piled back, and we were not allowed in. This suddenly made the whole sequence of the previous day useless, and the reveal, as in what was in the tomb, as seeing what lay in the sarcophagus, all important. We didn't have that. We didn't have a sequence. This, we believe, was deliberately done to prevent us telling a story, a very frustrating outcome given we had paid a massive amount of money to a local university for the exclusive rights to the dig. It was now the middle of the 1980s and I was now getting established. In the years that followed, I did many documentaries with a historical theme. The feature film Vincent, The Life and Death of Vincent van Gogh, shot in Holland and in Australia. In 1987, the 70mm show scan presentation celebrating us for the Australian Bicentenary. In 1989, the anthropological documentary Titicaca at the Edge of Heaven. In 1990-91, I produced the major four-hour series When the War Came to Australia, shown on ABC to commemorate 50 years since the start of the Pacific War. This series represented what had been for me a dream of 20 years, a goal to make a major historical documentary series after I'd seen the landmark BBC GBH Boston series Alistair Cook's America back in 1972. In 1993, the BBC co-production Ernie Dingo's Kimberley, one of an episode of the prestigious six-part BBC series Great Journeys. In 1995, I produced a four half-hour series titled In the Footsteps of Champagne Charlie for SBS. Excuse me. This was a race around the world, celebrating the journey in the 1860s of Charlie Heitzig, a champagne salesman for his family's famous Heitzig Champagne Company, and the man who became the inspiration for Jules Verne's Around the World in 80 Days. In 1996, I was a series producer on the 25 by half-hour oral history series Tales from a Suitcase for SBS Independent. This idea came out of a meeting with a wonderful broadcaster, a man of vision named Andy Lloyd-James. Andy was head of SBS Television at the time and wanted to increase the hours of Australian independent programming on his network. To do this, he set up SBS Independent and demoted himself to become its first head. As an old mate, I'd known him from the days of him being head of documentaries at ABC and, in fact, executive producing When the War Came to Australia. He invited me in to kick around ideas. Over a coffee, I told him I wanted to do more oral history, as this had produced extraordinary stories from the recently aired When the War Came to Australia. And also the ABC had asked me back to do more and look at ways that they could extend and use oral history. I'd always been fascinated because in England, people can actually watch people talk, sit down and talk. They can watch a half-hour show of someone talking to camera. This wasn't part of our television, and I really wanted to see that it could be. It was also a very inexpensive way of making history and getting the story of what I call the history of the backyard, those tiny, insignificant people that never get any history or never have any interest in them, give them a chance to tell their stories. We talked further, and from this came the idea of a very simple, minimalist oral history which would be low-cost programming, made in bulk and very charter, something important to SBS at that time. So, hallelujah, I left Andy's office with a 26-part, fully-funded series, something unheard of in production circles and a wonderful and exciting break for me. To date, I've produced nearly 50 half-hour episodes of Tales, and these have been playing continually on SBS since 1996. Yet when I go back now and ask about doing some more, I get comments like, this is too unsophisticated for SBS. We don't do that sort of programming now. This is a great shame because the original idea of Andy's was that we take each decade and make 26 half hours about the migrant experience during that time. The people that came in the 40s and the 50s were a very different group of people that came in the 60s and the 70s. And the waves of immigration were triggered by different things. These people were often quite powerless. Their story had never been told. They'd never had access to the media. And out of these stories came the most incredible and frightful stories. I mean, there was one that I remember of an old lady who lived, she's perhaps dead now, she lived down in Double Bay. And she was born in Australia, interestingly, and her father was a German diplomat and her mother was an Australian. And during the First World War, her father was interned, and her mother, the girls, her sisters and her, they went back to the mother's family. After the war, the family went to Germany. And this young woman became involved with a German gymnastic teacher who invented the ribbon twirling thing that they do in the Olympics. And in 1936, choreographed the opening ceremony of the Berlin Olympics. Here she was, this old, wizened little lady down in Double Bay you wouldn't look twice at. but had the most incredible story. And so many of them had fantastic stories of escape and of survival and of, you know, and we use this device of oral history to tell that spectrum of experience in the 40s and the 50s. So the idea was that we do 26 per year till we reach, you know, now. But management changes and you get these awful comments like, sorry, but it's too unsophisticated for us. In fact, it was a highly workshopped idea. We spent a lot of time getting it right. It rated double what, I mean, it'd get twos and threes, where SBS would get a half a rating point. SBS couldn't believe when it was going out that it created so much interest. Apart from soccer, it's had the most comments on radio, and they still run it. Yet their production people tell us that it's too unsophisticated. And I just say, well, why run it? Why are you still running it? It's probably on, you know, it's on every week still. This was very strange, as the SBS, I've just talked about the SBS schedule. During 98-99, I was the series producer on the Look Films, Film Australia co-production Our Century, a 26-part half-hour series for Channel 9, hosted by Ray Martin, which went to air during 1999 and told the history of the 20th century through the film archives in repositories around the country. And with this came a new problem: delivering history to commercial television, a commercial television audience that had little context, little historical knowledge, and even less interest. So how do we approach this? First was a major television star as your presenter, i.e. Ray Martin. Next, you use pace, music, flashy visual effects, and a massive publicity campaign to drive this to a new audience. Viewers of commercial television, especially those loyal to a network, could be sold on upcoming programs, especially if they were considered good for you, a bit like bran with your breakfast. Second, we had to make the history understood, popular and dramatic, by choosing strong themes for each program, like sport, crime, cars, holidays, morality, etc. We were able to corral the information and spoon-feed this in predictable and easily swallow-size 20-minute mouthfuls. And it worked. It rated and was very popular. We had history on. People love Ray Martin. They cheered Farlap again. They booed the Poms for bowling bodyline and cried as the boys struggled up the Kokoda track. This was emotional stuff, which people either did not know about or remembered it with strong emotions. And what this showed to the broadcasters was that even history could be made to be entertaining, providing they did their commercial television magic on the stories and the information. History programming had arrived. Parallel to this, there was the growing popularity of the History Channel out of New York and a smattering of history-themed programming on Discovery, National Geographic, and, of course, the ABC. And so from the late 1990s, as digital started to replace analog, so serious history programming was replaced by more shallow, trivial program ideas, simply entertainment. The good thing was, history was at last finding an audience, and this to me was the main thing. The style, the production qualities, and the presentation of this history, however, was not for me. But this is not important. People were tuning in and the History Channel was suddenly in the top 10 most popular channels on Foxtel and Austar. For my part, I could seed history into the television documentaries I made all the better. And so, though this was not strictly a historical in nature, I found myself the series producer of a 12-hour series titled Railway Adventures Across Australia, which included historical railways, locomotives and stories from the nation's past. During 2000, I produced a second series of Tales from a Suitcase, 13 half-hours, and this was followed the year after by a third series called The Afghan Experience. SBS didn't want to keep rolling these decades of migration over, so we actually saw the changes and could relate a bit better to the continuity in the timeline of history. They just wanted to jump to the things that they thought were important, i.e. the Afghan boat people and things like that. This was very different programming from anything around. It was simple, minimalist, and very cheap to produce. We could shoot a complete show in a morning, have this transcribed and marked up quite quickly, and get it edited and post-produced within a couple of weeks. And it was instantly popular, securing surprising ratings for a half-hour show that was basically someone sitting on their lounge with a mantelpiece in the background and telling us of their migrant experience. Who would ever expect a half-hour talk and history show would work? In 2003, I co-produced a documentary on Ned Kelly for the ABC, Channel 4 and National Geographic, a co-production with the London company Windfall. This involved reenactment, a new storytelling device for me, and one that, although helped tell the story, somehow seems like cheating to me, the lazy man's way of explaining history. But reenactment was to become the device of the future and the way of getting history to a broader audience. While budgets were much higher and the need for actors, props, simple sets and larger crews, the broadcasters saw in this type of film a crossover between drama and documentary and something immediately visual, entertaining and graphically advertised. So here was another thing that was driving me away from the production of what I wanted to do, more serious, real and well-researched programs that didn't require reenactment, people dressed in silly clothes. It was all becoming hard. In 2004, two projects came up that gave me a new hope for the future in my style of history programming, history making. First was a series of 28 short films, fillers for television, or interstitials as they like to call them, for the History Channel, which I called In Our Collection. The idea was, using this generic series title, I could go to any museum in Australia and make a series of short films about aspects or items within the collection and make short filler programs that could then be shown on the History Channel. For this first series, which I then titled In Our Collection, The Australian War Memorial, I wanted to make short films of 2 to 10 minutes in length, which told something of the provenance and history behind pieces in the collection. Quite typically, I would find a relic that had been restored, tell the story of the restoration through the curator or specialist who undertook this work, and then from the film and photographic sections of the collection, find suitable images to tell the broader history and the story. And the AWM have a fantastic resource in this regard. One story was on a small Australian tank that had been destroyed in the fighting at Bunagona in northern New Guinea. Excuse me. The turret was on display, so we filmed this along with the senior curator, Mike Cecil, telling the story about the tank during the battle. I then started to look for supporting film material, and bugger me, there was footage of the actual tank in the days before the battle, the crew happy and smiling, and then footage of it crashing through the jungle, the actual same tank. Mike relates how the tank ran up onto a stump of a palm tree the Japanese had cut down, and I was astonished to then find a photograph of the very tank stuck on the stump. This was real and far better than reenactment and historical programming. This worked for me. Mel Booth, my friend, while head of the research centre at the AWM, also did a couple of short films telling me about the map of a Burma railway stolen by an Australian and hidden for the duration of the war, and also the story of the Balmoral Gun, overrun and damaged by North Vietnamese forces during the Vietnam War. The second film that I started work on in 2004 was through a tender I won. The government of Norfolk Island wanted a series of 4 10-minute films on the history of the island for the 150th anniversary of the coming of the Pitcairn people to Norfolk. I won the contract. This quickly became a labour of love. I had to research, write, produce and direct the films on a tiny budget and have these ready for the anniversary in June 2006. These were duly made and delivered with the assistance of Professor Ian McCallman, who presented the history to camera at various locations around the island. one thing I tried to do here was to actually, I had very few visual elements of or photographs of the period of history. So one of the things I tried was to actually get the historian, Professor McCalman, to present the complete story to camera over which I could then overlay the images and show artifacts and fill in once I had that sort of bed of story. This sojourn on Norfolk Island completed an interesting cycle for me, a circle for me. Having my first documentary tell the story of the Bligh descendants, and this series telling the story of the mutineer leader, Fletcher Christian, and the part Tahitian descendants of the mutineers that now lived on Norfolk Island. My last film, which I'm completing now, is called The Roar of the Kitty Hawk, and it's about RAAF fighter planes in the Second World War. Since 2002, I've had 7 books published. Tales from a Suitcase in 2001, a book of transcripts that I co-edited, really, with the director of the series. The year after, I did the Tales from a Suitcase, the Afghan Experience book, in the same way. They're really an edit of transcripts. And then in 2004, I had published a book called Fighting Massoud's War, and it was the story of one of these, an Afghan who I'd turned up in the Tales series. And he'd been a fighter for the great warlord Massoud. You might know Massoud, but he was killed on the 2 days before 9/11. He probably knew something about it, and he was killed by a suicide film crew, television crew. And he was the leader of the Northern Alliance. So when the Americans came into Afghanistan, it was the Northern Alliance that supported the Americans, and the Northern Alliance people and Massoud's people that now run Afghanistan today. In 2006, I had published Somme Mud, a book that Mal talked about, which was from a manuscript written by Private Edward Lynch in the late 20s when he was a returned soldier from the First World War. He'd written a massive novel of his experiences, historically very accurate. It had lay in the family since the late 20s. His grandson, Mike, was a friend of mine. He showed me and I started to read it and went, this is something very special. And as Mal said, it's now becoming, it's considered something of a national treasure and Australia's version of All Quiet on the Western Front. In the footsteps of Private Lynch, I wrote in 2008, which was a contextual history of that book, because Lynch's novel threw up so many problems or questions that needed some sort of answer. The characters in it, the places he was, the dates and times, and for those interested historically in Somme Mud, this gave them a context for that book. Somme Mud was also published in the UK that year. It's been a bestseller, and it's going into schools. In fact, the junior version, a sort of a young reader's version, has just come out on the 1st of April. In 2009, saw the publication of the UK edition of Footsteps and some other things that I won't go into. During all this time, I've had many projects fall over for one reason or another. For example, I spent years trying to get up a series titled A Secret History of ASIO. Finding I could get little from the National Archives in Canberra due to the 30-year close period, I travelled to Moscow twice, interviewed scores of old KGB operatives, heard tall tales and true of their legendary past, and found out much about KGB operations in Australia during the Cold War, which was a real eye-opener. As part of this, I had uncovered an amazing case played out in the streets of Sydney at the very height of the Cold War. An English woman had befriended a Russian diplomat in New Zealand initially, but after she moved to Sydney with her son, found herself entangled with the local KGB chief, operating out of the Russian embassy in Canberra. Reporting this to Australian security, they put her to work as a double agent, supplied her with semi-secret tidbits, and then filmed and recording her meetings with a KGB operative. This is all around Sydney. And this film, along with her diary, was available to me. It was just too good to be true, and what great material, I thought, for a documentary. But do you think I could get any interest? Women commissioning editors saw it as too boisy, while male commissioning editors didn't enthuse to the idea or get excited about what this said about what was going on right here in Sydney, while a Cuban missile crisis played out across the world, directly threatening nuclear war. But like many projects, broadcasters were not interested, had no context for my stories and my history, and were simply ignorant. And this is the rub. Dealing with people who simply do not know what you're talking about, don't care, don't see history as important, and do not want it as part of their programming schedule. Another case in point. Through a high-level official working in our embassy in Hanoi, I heard that the son of the great Vietnamese nationalist leader Bo Nguyen Giap wanted to invite a Western film crew to Hanoi to make a film about his father's extraordinary life. Having studied the Vietnam War, I certainly knew who General Giap was. He was Ho Chi Minh's general from 1944 until the late 1980s, and oversaw the defeat of the colonial French at Dien Bien Phu, ending French colonial administration in his country, and later the defeat of the American and Allied forces during what they termed the American War. This was indeed a major figure of history, one of the great Cold War warriors, in fact the Bin Laden of his time, and today a living treasure in Vietnam. He's something like 98 and still alive. But do you think I could get broadcaster interest in a film on Giap in Australia? Even when I mentioned I had access to 90 kilometres of unseen black and white 35mm archive, still the lights didn't go on. Quite simply, they did not know who I was talking about, even who Ho Chi Minh was, though they did acknowledge they'd heard of him. So you curse silently under your breath and leave these bastards to their ignorance. In fact, looking back to the early 1980s when I started history production, no one wanted history. Today it is massively popular genre, as I've noted above, and a popular genre on a range of documentary and pay free-to-air channels. This is only one example of the problems of making documentaries, any documentaries, and for me, historical documentaries. What are the other problems, I hear you ask? Well, let's go through the process and see where we hit the wall. To start, you need development money, and for this you need a basic proposal. Here is where you hit the bureaucratic wall, the officious drones and the industry acolytes. It is as though none of these people studied history anywhere at any level and only see value, i.e. providing development funding, for social, anthropological or feminist subjects. If you're a one-legged Aboriginal lesbian, you probably have a chance, but an ageing straight Anglo male who likes history, forget it. Don't dare try military history. It's a huge no-no. So given we get no development funding, we use our own time, money, pay for our travel, our research materials, legal costs, and perhaps some initial filmmaking. Already we are out of pocket and have spent generally months without any pay at all, such is the intensity of the work. From this comes two things. A written proposal and usually some sort of audio-visual presentation to show what the documentary is about. This is an especially important tool for commercial networks as they have no idea what you are talking about and they just want to know if it'll rate. As producers, we learn early that when we are working for commercial television, you are just there to provide filler programming between the commercial breaks. Anything that will get the audience to the next block of commercials in 5 or 10 minutes' time and prevent them turning over to some other channel. But these short audiovisual presentations are very important. I've shown a promo, as we call it, to a broadcaster who, even before the short 5-minute presentation is finished, have already agreed to buy my program. Now, armed with a proposal and a program, you march off to the broadcasters to pitch your idea and get them to commit in what we call a pre-sale. This is another agonising, humiliating process, as often the person you are pitching to is a dill, has little television experience and is themselves a frustrated producer or director. These days, with my contempt for them obvious and certainly public, I do not venture into their broadcasting sanctums, where these people rule supreme, look down their noses at your ideas and pretend they're interested and involved. It is just an awful game where literally hundreds of producers with a whole spectrum of experience go through this humiliating process, and at times degrading process, to come out shattered and depressed that the idea that they've thought so terrific, like my ideas on JARP and on ASIO, that cost so much to develop and took so much time, are so easily dismissed and flicked into the garbage bin that lies just beyond their desks. Probably 8 or so years ago, I realised I'd come to a watershed in my career. No longer did the experience I have as a producer count anymore, as the commissioning editors and the decision makers were now much younger than me, often had very little experience and certainly did not want someone telling them what I knew. They instead turned to their generation of filmmakers, those who had graduated with them from film school, TAFE or wherever, and now saw filming, saw safety in giving pre-sales to them instead. I was too old. My ideas were dated and my experience worthless. I remember going to the annual documentary conference, the AIDC in Byron Bay, some 6 or 8 years ago. I hate conferences at the best of times, and found myself wanting to get out of the industry while all about me were young people banging on the door trying to get in. Perhaps it was this that turned me to writing. Then in about 2005, I was invited by Professor Ian McCallman to do a PhD through the Research School of Humanities at ANU, something I saw as a challenge and a way of documenting my experience with history filmmaking. I'm still working on my thesis titled Confronting History, and the challenges and problems there are in presenting history to a broader audience. And it is this aspect of history, that of the historical documentary, that has been such a unique aspect of the historical spectrum. The challenge for me is to confront history, not as history per se, but as entertainment. And to do this, I must use the tools of storytelling at my disposal. I must also be prepared to, quote, sugarcoat the pill, add a bit of myth and magic, without, of course, debasing historical fact. But in writing a PhD, I'm also determined to continue the requirement of being accessible, being understood and relevant. So many PhDs, to me, seem pointless, their research effort wasted on information that does not translate, cannot be picked up and used, and most importantly, advance a historical debate. Losing this access by overwriting, theorising and overanalysing history is just the converse of the problem I've had with the digital dumbing down of history. One perhaps dumbs up, the other dumbs down. But most of all, I must place this history within the context that can be understood and appreciated. The expansion of history on television into the digital age has been terrific, if for no other reason that it can now reach a broader audience. But the downside is that history programming is just seen by the digital samurai as yet another form of raw entertainment, much like sport, fashion news, reality shows, cartoons, music and comedy. The people who buy and schedule programs just want action, drama, excitement and ratings, caring little about serious history or aspects of history that are unknown or perhaps controversial. Hence we see great slabs of history, ancient Rome, dinosaurs and war. Exciting, sure, dramatic and easily advertised, sure, but far from serious considered history. Thank God for the BBC History Unit and a few other broadcasters and producers like Ken Burns in America and Brian Lapping in England, who keep quality history programming alive. The public broadcasters like the ABC have the budgets, but there are very few independent producers like myself who have the clout, respect and broadcaster support that can make a living from this genre. We have also seen the rise and rise of the big budget reenactment documentaries. These, as I have said, are attractive to broadcasters, but unless you're a Film Australia, now absorbed into Screen Australia, there is no way you can find $750,000 to fund a documentary for which there is absolutely no market for such films outside of Australia. You might get back $150,000 from a sale to the ABC, but this leaves you with a $600,000 shortfall. This then highlights the digital production dilemma. On one hand, the trivialising, the acting out and the dumbing down of historical programming, while on the other, the large budget reenactments, great television often, but completely unsustainable financially. Perhaps we instead should look sideways at some of the old, tried and successful devices in historical storytelling that do not require reenactment, large budgets and flashy production values. Perhaps here is an answer in a halfway house, a way of both confronting history and getting it to the broad and more discriminating audience who I believe exists out there and longs for its return. This then takes me back to my historical journey, a long, rough and rocky road where persistence, a belief in the importance of history and my intrigue in what I call the history of the backyard, the history of the common man, the powerless and the forgotten, makes it all worthwhile. But we must all, in wherever our history endeavours lay, confront history to make it understood, appreciated and loved, and only then can we let the sword of history sleep in our hand. Thank you.
We've got about 10 minutes for questions before people probably have to leave at 1. Will's also got some copies of his book of the film Beneath Hill 60 to sign, so I'll open it up to questions here. People might want to ask something about, or you might want to talk about.
Yeah, I didn't get to that, but just quickly, this is Beneath Hill 60 is a feature film that comes out next week. It's about the Australian tunnellers in the First World War and their terrible fight beneath Hill 60 in Belgium. I was invited in May last year to write the book after the film had been funded and was starting production. I was given 20 weeks to write the book. I had to deliver an 80,000 word manuscript to Random House by October the 1st. Fortunately, I knew something about the context of the history. I know a lot about the tunnellers. I certainly knew about Messines Ridge and the First World War. But I had the advantage of a guy in Townsville who'd spent the last 20 years researching this subject, and he gave me access to his files and books and everything, and I just got into it, and that came out of it. If anyone's interested, I've got a three-minute little promo.
Yeah, go.
This is a trailer for the film Beneath Hill 60 that, as I said, is is released on the 15th of April. So this might give you a bit of a sense of what it's about. Now, have we got sound here, mate?
I think there's sound. Down below.
That's right.
Oh, is that you?
Informed the mining battalion. Both from the miners and engineers.
Correct.
I like being as good men. Cross the foggles. Joined up.
Thank you.
Okay. My book came out on the 1st of March, 6 weeks before that. If anyone's interested, I've got a few copies here I can sell and sign. Any questions?
Only one. Do you find among your peers in other countries, North America, and UK for instance, that they're confronted with these intergenerational hostilities that you've encountered here?
Exactly the same. A very, very good friend of mine has a production company in the west of England, and his partner is the ex-head of documentaries at BBC Bristol. Now, these two guys are hugely experienced, highly regarded, and they can't get any work. It's common the world over. And I mean, the old idea of the producer in a little office, I'm a dinosaur. You know, it's totally different. The whole structure of the industry is different. The way my 32-year-old son, who's an editor, makes programs is totally different to me. It's a bit like I'm the builder of a lovely clinker wooden boat that takes a year to handcraft this boat. And people look at it and say, what a wonderful, beautiful bit of art or boat. But they don't want to buy it. They want the boats that my son makes out of fiberglass, and he punches two of them out over a weekend because they're cheap and they do the same thing. It's a rough analogy, but that's the same thing. It's a serious generational thing.
Do you think there might be a backlash in a while when people are getting so sick of those reality shows? And, you know, I think I was watching the Channel 9 last night and I was just amazed at what passes for, I don't even know if it's entertainment, but people, I mean, the ratings are changing, the free-to-air, I mean, I think recently even their second channels are doing well, taking away from, so, and with, you know, pay TV, and the History Channel, the Studio, the new channel, which has just started, which is fascinating. Yeah. Do you think that there might be some sort of backlash, and soon people are going to be saying, you know, this is rotting my brain, I want something a little bit better, and it might be, you know, a new industry opening somewhere?
We'd love to think so. I mean, the whole thing is that these people, like the broadcast, you know, the program inventors, are just looking for genres that rate. Now, I've got to say this. They don't care what it is. It could be history. It could be watching lawn bowls. It could be anything. I mean, I could never understand how Channel 9 could run a gardening show and how popular gardening was on Channel 9. But Burke's Backyard really, really worked. But the good thing is anything's possible. The good thing is who knows? And you go to them and you say, what do you want? And they say, we'll know it when we see it. It's jungle. Nothing, you know. And all these program formats like, you know, Big Brother and all of that, they come from overseas. They pay massive amounts of money for the format rights. They make a local version. Some of them work, some of them don't. Or if they're invented here, they can sell them. I mean, that's not commonly known, but who wants to be a millionaire as an Australian format? The BBC pinched it off the Australian guy that invented it. He took them to court and won, and I think won £56 million. It's not commonly known, but formats are hugely... There's huge faith in them by the commercial broadcasters, but the ABCs and the SBSs and the little sort of pay channels will struggle along. They're all looking for ratings. I mean, the day that SBS and ABC don't have to rate is the day we'll get better programming.
Do you think that print media is actually kind of the print media? Do you think it's kinder in kind of welcoming these historical novels or historical books, like publications houses? Would they be more interested, do you reckon, than actually like the visual media?
I mean, we always keep hearing that book sales are dropping, but Australians are the biggest book buyers in the world per capita. Electronic books are coming. I mean, now I sign a contract at Random House and I've got to give away or include all sorts of talking books and, you know, online books. And I mean, I don't know if you know the process, but there's now printing of books in bookshops where you can go in and actually find the book you want and push a button and come back in 15 minutes and they'll print the book for you on the spot. I mean, I think people still like holding something. They like putting it in their bag and sitting in bed with it. They don't want to watch it on a computer. The same with newspapers in a way. You know, we're watching, perhaps reading newspapers online, but something special about folding the Herald over and looking it over a cup of tea, you know.
Electronic books, if there was some, as the market increases, could electronic books have the financial clout to be able, in fact, to take up where programming will not go? For example, with electronic books, they're starting to bring in interactivity between the reader, so the reader can almost go off where they want to. So is that an option? People like yourself, should that format ever get enough of the money in order to support what you need to do?
At this time, fortunately, the people that are running the publishing houses are educated and are sensible, but they're obviously commercial, so they're going to be looking at any option that's available. All these things are market-driven. If people want talking books or online books, they're going to get them. There's plenty of publishers out there ready to buy the rights to my books and put them up online.
I think I meant the added value. So, for example, when you write your book, Scott, in your expertise as a filmmaker as well, bringing that element into that book. I mean, who wants to read a book that is only, you know, when you can have a book in your hand and read it in bed? Why should you want to read just the same thing on the screen? You want the added value of
that. That's right, yeah. I mean, I don't know that there's a lot of that yet happening, but I can see it won't be long. And, you know, for a film like this, there's a whole lot of ancillary things. There are online websites and chat shows and teacher's notes and all sorts of things that immediately are part of that spectrum of Twittering and Facebooking and all that. And they're all important, and they're all... But, again, it's driven by people wanting that. I mean, there's been technologies that have come, and we think, wow, the future is putting these gloves on and being interactive with the film I'm watching. But that came and went. No one ever got into this sort of putting helmets on and glasses on and feeling you're actually doing something and you're part of it. So who knows? It's a really wilderness, you know. It's things, there's a whole lot of that stuff going backwards and forwards and people, what if? What if we can do this? Well, is there a market for the what ifs?
We might just have one more question and then I'll call it to a close.
Oh, well, let somebody else do.
No, go.
I'm just very curious about whether you need to build. It seemed as though you were implying that there's a lack of direction from what I heard. And I wonder whether the basis of that is cultural. And in rationalising about Aboriginal things and acknowledging all of that sort of thing, I went to a talk the other day by an Aboriginal who looked like a Scotsman who'd been in the suntan thing, and he acknowledged the land and all that sort of thing, but he didn't acknowledge his Scottish name, and which brings up the whole thing about culture and... I wonder whether, in fact, we have to... I mean, the culture of Australia is you make as much money as you can, because that we're all migrants and we all came here and we all want to make a new beginning. So if we need to have a drive, which is coming... Now, I'm just thinking... in the 1960s on an island in Greece where there was only a boat coming once a week and... dozing in the siesta, a bell ringing and saying, come and see how Karayozi slays the dragon. And the bloke in the cafe and put up a sheet and had a lantern behind, and the shadow puppets came out. And you know, I wonder whether we're caught up in technology, and we really are very, very... We haven't even managed to bridge the Aboriginal-European divide yet. So these stories which give us our culture and tell us our story are still are being taken away by the sophisticated technology that is all European or American or advanced societies who have 2,000, 5,000 years of culture. And we haven't even begun to get anywhere with it. And I'm wondering whether, you know, if there needs to be a direction coming, and we have to say this is what it is that we're promoting, and it has to sort of take slow, go slowly through. Sorry, that's very long winded. Yeah.
You need, should I comment?
Please do.
I mean, part of the problem, once we, if we mention culture or this is, you know, something we must be doing or we must understand, that's the biggest turnoff for the broadcasters you can even begin. You just don't even go there. I mean, we're talking about trying to get them, you know, we're trying to get them locked in to just listen to us. And often with commercial television, it's a joke there because you say, look, my idea is a bit like that, and it's got an element of that program. Programs they know, of course. It's a bit like that, and a bit like that, but it's really like that. So my idea is like this. And, yeah, I get it. It's sort of, you know, they get it because it's got a framework around it. The ABC and the SBS are a bit different. At least they've got some understanding of what I'm talking about, but people just aren't interested in history. So if I'm up against people that don't care, I'm buggered from the moment I walk in the door.
That's the subject.
Yeah. I can't say this is about General Sharp, even though, you know, you mention him anywhere else, and people, you know, I've mentioned him to America and the French and things, and they go, wow, he's still alive, this old tiny little sparrow of a man who was, you know, hugely important in history.
I'll have to draw it to a close there. From a library perspective, we really appreciate this because I think you've demonstrated this to us just how hard it is to generate content. And even though you have such an extraordinary record of generating visual content in film over many years, and more recently with books that have been extraordinarily popular, and you can, he's one of the few authors in Australia who can talk to a publisher, or a publisher will drag him up to quickly write a book, as is the case with Beneath All 60. So very appropriate to hear from you from a library perspective, and also around this time of the year as we approach Anzac Day to remind us of why we have Anzac Day. I'd like to thank all those who turned up, and to thank you, Will, for
thank you very much
coming to talk to us today. So can we thank him in the